podcast listeners. Welcome to the Psychology of Video Games podcast. My name is Jamie Madigan, and I've made it my mission in life to apply psychology to understanding video games, how they're designed, what impacts they have on people, and how we can approach them on our own terms. To do that, in every episode of the podcast, I interview an expert on the overlap of some area of psychology and video games. This is the episode about using video games in therapy. Also remind you that I've got a website at psychologyofgames.com that you can go and find literally hundreds of articles about psychology video games, as well as dozens of episodes of the podcast to go through. You can also find out how to subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to the website, follow me on social media, support me on patreon.com, and a lot of other cool stuff. So go to psychologyofgames.com. Psychology is a big and diverse field, and to be honest, since it's just you and me here, I'm only familiar with a few parts of it. My PhD is in industrial organizational psychology, which is the study of the psychology of the workplace, and I do read a lot about social psychology, behavioral economics, the psychology of decision making, media psychology, cognitive biases, and all that kind of stuff. I've also dipped my toes into research on computer user interface, cognitive psychology, and even neurobiology. But the one area that I'm kind of woefully uneducated is the entire swath of psychology that has to do with mental health and therapy. That is, people who work with individuals or small groups to help them through trauma, diagnose and treat mental or developmental issues, or even just help people make sense of the world when they need it. It is, ironically, the kind of psychology that most people probably think of when they hear the word. I just never got into it. The clinical psychology students in my graduate school program were people who sat in on our advanced statistics classes and muttered that they really didn't need this stuff. We dealt in populations and mean group differences, and they were more interested in individuals and theory and case studies. I mean, they were all cool and we got along. Though one of them did bring a baggie full of psychedelic mushrooms to a Christmas party once and proceeded to spend the evening tripping out on the couch. But I'm sure he's helping people now. Anyway, it's kind of a shame that I don't know a whole lot about mental health issues and therapy, because I think that video games can definitely intersect with those topics. I think video games can help you develop critical mental and emotional skills like dealing with failure and frustration. Video games can help you understand the value of practice and effort. They can help teach social skills like cooperation and how to appropriately indulge in competition and rivalry. I think video games can teach you how to empathize with other people, be they real or fictional, and I think they can instruct you on how to appropriately interact with them. And video games can be very handy tools for getting people, especially kids, in a therapy situation to open up and start communicating in what would otherwise be a super weird and off-putting situation. This is exactly the kind of thing that I'm going to talk about in this episode with my guests, who work as psychologists and other therapists helping kids, families, and others by incorporating video games into their therapy sessions. That's coming up in just a minute. All right, everybody, welcome to the interview portion of the podcast. And on this episode, we have got a full house. First time I've ever done three guests at once. The previous record was two people. So congratulations to the people from Electronic Gaming Therapy Incorporated. You guys are the new record holders. But welcome to the Psychology Games podcast.
Thank you.
So you want to go around the room there and introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do?
I'm Dr. Brian Moyer. I am a clinical psychologist in private practice and one of the members of Electronic Gaming Therapy and a serious gamer.
Great.
I am Liz Messer. I am a clinical social worker, also part of Electronic Gaming Therapy. I am a serious wife and mother of, I'm a wife and mother of serious gamers.
Okay. So honorary serious gamer. Got it.
I am Drew Messer. I am also a clinical psychologist and one of the partners here at Electronic Gaming Therapy. It just goes to say I'm a gamer as well. To do what we are doing, if you're going to use games, electronic games or video games as part of therapy, you got to know games. You got to be a gamer of some sort.
Sure. And you're a Cubs fan. I suppose we should just put that out there.
We're going going to the World Series after 71 years, Jamie.
All right. I know what some of those words meant. So one of the reasons I'm really excited to do this episode is that there's a lot of different areas of psychology as a field. And sort of my wheelhouse has always been around more on the social psychology side and the work psychology and psychology around decision making and cognitive and so forth. And I've never really studied or been involved with any of the psychology that has to do with mental health or use of psychology and therapy in the context that you guys do. So I'm glad to not only talk more about that, because I think it's really interesting and it's probably what most people think of when they think of psychology. But you guys also use video games there. So what is Electronic Gaming Therapy, your company, and what do you do there with video games?
Electronic Gaming Therapy, Inc. is simply the name that we gave the group of ourselves, our clinic, if you will. We are all three independent practitioners. We just happen to work together under the same roof. We chose that name, the name of Electronic Gaming Therapy, because we wanted to highlight, we wanted people to be aware of the fact that we use video games as part of therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, what we do is therapy. I mean, don't lose sight of the main thing that we do is therapy with families, with individuals, with groups. If we use games in therapy, video games are simply a complement to that therapy. Ultimately, the game is not the therapy. The therapy is the therapy.
Okay.
Anything to add to that?
No, I thought that was well played.
Thanks.
So who are your clients? Like, what kinds of people do you work with?
On the individual therapy level, we work with a lot of people who are on the autism spectrum, especially high functioning, what used to be referred to as Asperger's, mm-hmm. Other neurodevelopmental issues such as the famous attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. But we also incorporate with anxiety, depression, things like that. But also, in addition to in the office, we've also gone out and done some consultations with schools, working with students with special needs, agencies focusing on developmental disabilities. What else would we add?
Before we even came to Buffalo, Brian worked with kids in a residential setting. I used the Wii on an inpatient unit at a state psychiatric hospital. We've been in medical settings, all different places.
Okay, so you got electronic gaming right there in the name of your clinic. So I guess I'll just toss out what may be an overly broad question, so you can kind of approach it however you like. But just how can video games be used effectively in therapy, and what kinds of therapy are we talking about here?
And thinking about it, I think first and foremost, the video games help in building a relationship. I mean, ultimately, therapy and is getting someone to engage in a conversation. If I can't get someone, I suppose it's the same for a teacher or for anybody who's working with kids. If you don't get them to join with you, if you don't get them to engage and talk, then it's hard to provide any help. You know, it's not infrequent that an adolescent child will come in, for example, and be totally resistant to coming to see a psychologist.
Sure.
It's not high on the list of things on kids' lists that they want to do. Just in terms of making it easier for a kid to come, in terms of facilitating, in terms of getting a relationship started, you know, a kid who sits down in my office and sees the PS4 and the new virtual reality headset and the Xbox One and the Wii U and the Amiibos.
Yeah.
The kids can't help but kind of look at you like, what in the hell am I doing? Where did you take me? Whoops, sorry. No bad words.
That one's fine.
But you get that reaction right off the bat, and right there you have common interest of discourse, of talking, you know. Ooh, have you done the virtual reality headset yet? Have you played Smash Brothers on the Wii U yet with 8 people? I for me, at least from my standpoint, that's one of the first things that stands out, is it provides a context. It provides you an entranceway, an invitation into a kid's world, and it gives you something to begin talking about.
So it makes a real effective icebreaker and sort of breaks down some barriers that kids going into what they see as a weird situation are probably going to throw up.
But We've also found some other really interesting and fun things with our video games. You know, a lot of the work we're doing is cognitive behavioral therapy. So we're trying to help them look at their thoughts, look at their emotions, and how to structure them better. And one of the neat things about video games is, especially in terms of emotions, for example, back in the old days in my master's thesis, group social skills training, we would do a lot of role play. What would you do if an adult approaches you and is angry at you? How would you cope with it? Mm-hmm. Or how would you cope with it when you're frustrated? And instead of having to do this boring and very difficult for a lot of kids role play, when we're playing video games, we can kind of extract those kind of emotions through gameplay. Instead of imagining being frustrated, how about if you're being beaten by an old guy who shouldn't even know what a video game is, let alone be able to beat you?
Yeah, I suppose you have one of those old guys on staff who can step up and administer a beatdown.
Yeah, it's
a beat
me.
But wait a second, that's not fair, because by the time the adolescents and the middle school and high school kids start coming in, I know old guys are beating them in some of the games. Then we turn to picking games or selecting games where we can manipulate the game conditions so that they have to lose.
Oh, interesting. And what does that net you? What does that help with?
For my elementary school age kids, telling them that they have to lose. And it won't be unusual to have a family early on come in and have them play Wii Party game, the chop chop game, where you're chopping up a vegetable four people at once. And announcing to the two elementary school-aged children and the two parents, okay, everybody, we're going to let mom win this first game. And to have an elementary school child literally flop on the floor in protest over, what do you mean I have to let somebody else win?
So building frustration tolerance,
okay.
Changing around the dynamics of family and power and control, you're in a situation where the parents maybe even a little overbearing, and to put the child in a position of control, or the opposite, where the child seems to manipulate the family system, and we rearrange the structure so that, as Drew just described, where the child has to lose. So it gives us access and opportunities to do things both with the families and with the individuals that's otherwise hard to do without the use of video games.
Yeah. So when we were talking earlier before we started recording, you were talking about using video games to help repair some of those familial relationships, like in divorce, you know, family divorce settings and that type of thing. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, that probably the more difficult kind of work you do in a private practice setting is working with families where the parents have divorced and there's a lot of conflict between them that kind of spills down to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the kids might have had a good relationship with both parents, and then about a year or two after divorce, the kids are saying that they not only don't want to see the other parent, they don't even want phone calls or a birthday card or anything.
Oh, man, that's rough.
That's tough. So part of the challenge is figuring out how to bring those families, how to bring the non-preferred parent, if you will, back together with the kids. And the games have proven a fun, effective way of accomplishing that sometimes. I mean, the neatest example for me just in the last 2 weeks, ever since that VR headset came out with the PlayStation 4, was the child for months has not wanted the preferred, non-preferred parent to even be in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And these last 2 weeks, he's put on the VR headset and allowed the dad to be in the room. And I think part of the reason it worked is because the VR headset has given him a sense of safety and security. And now we're moving from, oh, now he took it off and let dad put it on. So we've started an interaction. Granted, they're not talking yet, but they're engaging together and sharing
shared experience.
And hopefully in another few weeks, we'll get a multiplayer game going where they're cooperating. And I'll try to get them on Portal 2, for example, where, mm-hmm. Hey, let's solve some problems together, and then kind of use that as a metaphor to what other problems might you two be able to work together and solve?
Yeah, a lot of times being able to add structure of a game to an otherwise very awkward, unstructured situation, whether it's a child sitting down with a non-preferred parent, whether it's an adolescent who doesn't really want to talk about or isn't comfortable talking about his feelings. That unstructured setting of, okay, what seems to be the problem? Sit down on the couch and tell me everything becomes a lot easier when you say, well, why don't we sit down and play a video game? We'll talk while we play. Or why don't we get the whole family and playing a video game together? And we can kind of start some interaction based on that. And yet another way that incorporating video games has been really helpful in the private practice we do.
Okay. So what about helping kids, or I guess anyone, deal with like peer relationships? Because those are obviously important as well. They say that your peers, as you get older, particularly has a big impact on your character and your behavior. How do you incorporate games into that sort of activity?
You know, it's funny. Right before the podcast, I was re-listening to an earlier podcast you did with Dr. Cowart.
Oh, yeah.
When she was talking about the differences between kind of online relationships, offline relationships, and switching modalities. And I think that's something that we work with quite a lot. A lot of the kids we're working with really struggle with social skills. Sometimes it's on a developmental level, autism spectrum, things like that. Sometimes it's more out of anxiety and depression. Sometimes it's just difficulties at school socializing. And a lot of them find that, and she kind of referred to social compensation as a way to, when they're not comfortable or don't have certain social skills, they can compensate that with online relationships. So they find themselves doing a lot of that. And a lot of what we do is try to help kind of incorporate and help them use that as a transition point for live video gaming or live interactions, relationships, etc. Once a month, we have a really more of a socialization group where kids get together so that they're in one room playing video games together. It allows them to interact, again, in a structure that they're very comfortable with, and yet it forces them to be in the same room. And so a lot of the things that they don't have to work on they don't have to work on online, they have the benefit of the online gaming here and yet have to interact face-to-face too.
Mm-hmm. That's a tough area with parents. I think for all of us, it's not unusual for a family coming in to talk about, you know, we're really worried. Our kid is online. Our kid doesn't, he's not participating in any sports. He's not a band. He's not in any clubs. He's not going to Boy Scouts. You know, he comes home after school and, you know, he's online for hours and hours. And one of the first things I'll often ask about is, well, what kind of online is he doing? Is he online looking at YouTube videos? Is he online playing a game where he's not interacting with anybody? Versus, is he online with friends from school and they're playing together? Or is he online with, you know, quote, friends that he's met on the internet? You know, I go back to Dr. Cowart. I mean, that was really neat. I mean, she talked, I thought, wonderfully about how online relationships aren't a bad thing. And it's mm-hmm. it's been, I've done more education with families about, hey, I'd much rather have a family come in and tell me that their adolescent is at least interacting online. Because like Brian said, I think we can extend that and parlay that into real offline interactions.
So do those skills translate then? Or can you develop skills interacting with people while you're playing games and then use those to interact with people and make friends and make sense of the world in face-to-face contexts?
I would say yes and no. I think a lot of them are translatable, but I think a lot of them are what we're finding we're kind of helping and facilitating. The whole issue of anonymity, if you're playing online with people all over the world that you've never met before, it gives you a freedom, both in a good way, but also sometimes in a negative way. So we have a lot of times kids will come in and start that quote unquote trolling behavior.
Mm, right.
And we'll have to confront them with that and, you know, explain that it's not okay to incite emotion and anger just for the sake of your amusement.
Certainly not when you're sitting in a group of four people playing Halo or a group of eight people playing Smash Brothers on the Wii U, trolling and inciting anger online. It's very different when you're sitting in the room together.
Right. Yeah, the consequences can be very different, and even the level of like what's acceptable or not, I feel, differs when you're in a face-to-face context.
Maybe one of the things that I do is that because I'm not a active gamer, but I do a lot of work with the parents, and the parents are so concerned about their children and their behavior and how much time they're spending, who they're talking to, how they're managing their emotions, and, you know, et cetera. And so by bringing families into our practice, Dr. Brian or Drew will typically meet with the kids and do some work with the family. And I'll do a lot of work with the parents on trying to help them be more accepting and tolerant, I think, of video games from a positive, you know, perspective, and how they can be effective in helping their child develop the skills that Brian and Drew were just mentioning.
Yeah. So what are most parents' reactions, or what's the range of reactions that you see from parents where they say, you know, you want me to do what now? Or you're going to do what?
Not an unusual question of my intakes.
Right.
You know, I'll parents come in and say on an intake, so are you going to be playing games with my kid?
Or are you going to be working?
Are you going to be working?
And the answer is
sometimes people will think, so are you just, you know, I'm not going to pay money to have my kid or have insurance pay money for my kid to come in and play video games. But another common reaction, because I'll tell, for an individual client at the beginning, I'll say, you know, we'll probably play some video games, and mom, dad, I very likely will want you to come in and play as well with us. And a lot of times, well, sometimes I'll get parents going, oh yeah, I play video games all the time. But other times I get parents who say, I'm not a gamer. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the reason why we have such a range of games to play. You know, for the more advanced gamer, for an adolescent and their father, for instance, playing Halo may be an easy thing to do, or Portal 2. Whereas for inexperienced gaming parents, a lot of the Wii games are very basic, straightforward. Even going back before the Wii U, Wii Sports Bowling, or Drew mentioned Wii Party. Some of the mini games there are as simple as just making a chopping motion with the Wiimote.
Right.
You know, because of the name of our clinic too, Jamie, I have no doubt that there are lots of people who don't come to us because they see video games as evil.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I imagine there must be a lot of variance across ages, because I'm kind of part of the first generation of people that grew up with video games that were home consoles, and they were in a lot of homes. And then as the years have gone by, gaming has only become more popular, and it's only been more likely that any given household is going to have, you know, a gaming console. And then you're going to have people who grew up playing games on those consoles are now having children of their own. And do you find that there's a qualitative difference in the type of people that do understand games and maybe played them as a kid and then dropped off from the habit, but sort of understand what they are? And are there people who still play games to this day that kind of jump in with both feet?
You know, it's funny. You do get a wide variety. You get the people who have been gaming since they were young and remember some of the earliest text-based games on the PC. Even you get people who never played growing up, but you know, the app games, Candy Crush, etc., on the iPhone or the Android phones, etc. You know, they can relate to gaming in that context. And then some that, you know, where they would do neither of those, but, you know, they decided to buy a Wii because it was a great idea for the kids, and they thought they'd buy a Wii Fit board to get in shape. So it really is interesting, the variety of people that you come across and their different comfort levels with different gaming formats.
I think it is generational too, though, because I can think back to 2000 when I was doing a postdoc at the Children's Hospital. In the 16, 17 years since then, it's more common now for me to work with younger families, and the parents are gamers. The parents have been gaming, mm-hmm. like Brian said. I think the proportion of people who have that, oh no, they're bad, they're evil, you know, yeah, I think that's steadily going down and down.
Right. You would kind of expect it to, as, you know, something is normal to the extent that you see other people doing it. So the more people do it, the less extreme I suspect people's reactions are going to be. All right. What about schools? Are they into what you guys do, or do you partner with them ever?
You know, I'm going to talk about that just because we had a parent in our parents group the other night comment on it. We have tried, and I'm going to have the guys talk about their specific experience. But one of the things that we tried in one of the schools is to bring our socialization group using video games into the school setting. And as Drew and Brian were talking about, we use specific games and we actually create, we manipulate the game play so that it is cooperative, so that it is structured, and the effectiveness is what we want it to, you know, what we want it to be. And one of the dads of this group that we started in one of the schools was very saddened because the group dissipated. It no longer existed. And I asked, well, what do you think happened? He said, well, it became just a come on in and sit around and play your games versus a moderated group setting. And he felt that that was really a group. It was very disadvantageous to his son to be able to handle that kind of a just sort of a drop-in setting, and it still needed to be facilitated. And there's just not he doesn't feel that there's enough people out there who can facilitate that kind of group setting.
To add on to that, kind of piggyback off of that, one of the challenges we found sometimes in working both with schools and other agencies is they heard about us and they invite us in and we do some work with them and sometimes on a consulting level, and they start thinking of the video game as the therapy itself, and they go, oh, okay, I got it. So we'll just play Wii with the kids. And they miss out on the opportunities of learning some of the skills, whether it be coping strategies, whether it be social strategies, etc. So that's been a little bit of a frustration. But in terms of some of the work we've done in the schools, early on we were going into one of the schools in a small self-contained class with some really pretty low-functioning kids. A few of them were actually nonverbal, and they were elementary-aged. And just getting them to engage in the process of the video game. And one of the biggest goals, and this may sound small, but to the teacher and to us, it was kind of an accomplishment, is getting the one to turn to the next classmate and say, your turn. Ah. Simply the taking of turns and the acknowledgement of the other child and things like that was really useful in their socialization process.
My favorite school example were... I had two kids in second grade in two different classes and two different schools. They both had IEPs, and the IEP goal was to increase the frequency of initiating an interaction with a peer in the classroom and to increase appropriate responses to peers.
Okay.
We did a good behavioral baseline design over, you know, a six-week period, two observations a day. There was 0 to 1 initiated interactions per day. We brought the Wii in. Specifically, we used Wii Bowling, and we used Dance Party. And we set it up so that it didn't interfere with any classroom instruction, so we used the last 10 or 15 minutes of the lunch period. We set up a schedule of where we rotated the peers who would participate. We had the identified student approach the peers and ask, did they want to come play a video game at lunchtime? Nobody turned them down.
Who's going to say no?
One of the problems that surfaced was that the kids would start approaching the identified student, ooh, ooh, pick me today, pick me today.
As I get overwhelmed.
That's why we had to come up with a schedule. The as it went along, the entire class started returning earlier to the room to watch the student and the others play the game. The dance thing ended up being a class-wide activity because the other kids would start imitating the dance moves that the kids with the remotes were doing. The other thing I remember was we did a bowling game and the student hit a strike and the whole class erupted. I mean, as sometimes happens, to the point where she almost got overwhelmed and had to go sit in the corner and calm back down. But as we came back and did a posting and wrote up a quarterly IEP reports where it really did result in, hey, she started initiating. It generalized from that small intervention into the regular classroom setting. It was fun. I guess part of using the video games as part of therapy and doing interventions like that is it's fun work.
It sounds like it, yeah. And gratifying since you're helping people out and having fun with games at the same time. So I get emailed some weird questions, I think by people who just kind of find me on Google and have some pet theory or when I ask some question about games. And one of the ones that I get from time to time is like something along the lines of, what can I tell about a person based on what character he or she chooses in like Smash Brothers or something like that? Or what can I tell about a person, their psychology based on their favorite type of game and that kind of stuff? And my reaction is always kind of like, I don't know. Is that a thing? I can't help you. But kind of kicking that up a level, like, is there anything that you found that you can infer or at least like use to guide your interventions or your line of questioning about what kinds of games people are into or what choices they make when they can play this or that or play this way or that way?
I mean, of course, there's always an element of, this individual is more into this game or that game. A lot of our focus, I think, is, since it's on socialization, a lot of the kids come in playing the most popular games. Mm. You know, a lot of them are coming in playing Call of Duty. A lot of them are, Grand Theft Auto is a very popular one, although we don't play that in here because it's not really forwarding the kind of gameplay we're trying to focus on.
Yeah.
But
great game, though.
You know, it is. It is. I think I find the most interest in watching how they play more so than what they play. You know, with some of my kids who are on the spectrum, even before they start to play, they'll go in and explain a level of detail about a game that is just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a walking Wikipedia on that particular game.
Oh my God! Yeah, my daughters are into Pokemon, so I know exactly what you mean. Yeah,
that's my partner Drew here. Is I think he's actually gotten all the Pokemon Go.
I did.
Wow!
I did
with a little help from his son.
Okay.
But sometimes in terms of game choice, it's interesting to see who goes with the very socially conventional games, who goes for the sport games. I'll have some kids come in and you say, Call of Duty, and they're like, yeah, no, everybody plays that. But I always mispronounce this, FIFA, mm-hmm. or NHL, or Madden,
right.
or some of the more sports-oriented games. Then you have some that are more into the Nintendo games, like Smash Brothers or Super Mario Brothers, things like that. It's always an interesting thing. I try not to draw too many conclusions based on just a game choice, but we did find, I know Drew was very interested in
a shout out to Yee. I can't remember his first name. I have had more fun. Yeah, he was on your show twice, I think. And his gamer motivation profile. Anybody listening, go take that thing. It is so cool. I've had my kids and parents taking that thing. It's been fun comparing parent child scores on that profile. It's been fun seeing where people come out and the games. And yeah, I'll follow on Brian in that. It's always interesting to see what game they choose, or even like you. You ask, a particular character or choices they make during a game. Those are that is fun. I don't know that I draw a lot from it. It just seems, you know, after you've been doing this for 20, 25 years, it just becomes one big data bank. You think, and it just, you know, you don't specify it. You just get a feeling, oh yeah, this is a sports game. This is a sports game kit, or a Minecraft kit, or a first-person shooter kit, or you know, obscure games. That's always fun. Every once in a while, a kid will come in and, huh? What game are you talking about? Show me.
Right.
Pull it up. Let's get it. Let's look at it. Show me how you play.
You know, you'll also have some of those moments. Imagine you're playing Halo with a client, split screen mode, and we're like up on top of the hill looking down at a whole bunch of enemies. And I'm like, okay, you know, let's get out the sniper, right? Hello, hello, where? Oh my gosh, you're down there already shooting. And what happened to, you know, preparing for this?
Right.
You know, level of impulsivity.
Or if you keep killing me, and we're supposed to be cooperating, we're going to change games.
Right.
Right, right. So if we imagine a world that where video games don't exist, put it another way, like back before video games were commonplace or, you know, could be used in this kind of therapy, I imagine that you would be using like other types of games, like board games, card games, or maybe like trying to have these same interactions and draw out these same interactions with toys, or playing with Lego, or something along those lines.
You're exactly right.
Yeah, Jamie, before I had a laptop to try and entice kids to stay in a therapy session with Wheel of Fortune, you know, I had a chess checkers board game with a deck of cards and dominoes, mm-hmm. that we would just find sometimes the correct way to play the game or fun adaptations of the game. You know, a lot of therapy is building the relationship, and especially for individuals who aren't really comfortable with that kind of a relationship, finding non-threatening ways to help build that relationship, to allow to reach that point where you could talk about some difficult issues and things.
So is there anything special or more effective about video games? Like, why, put it another way, why are you not still busting out the checkers and instead taking out the Wii U or the PlayStation VR?
Have you tried the virtual reality headset yet?
A couple of times, yeah.
Okay. Does checkers or your chess or anything compare to?
I take your point.
Yeah, part of it, of course, is the wow factor. Part of it is that kids aren't sitting around playing cards or checkers. They're sitting around playing video games. So it's something that's more relatable. But the other thing is I think virtual reality is something we've gotten really excited about recently now that it's kind of pseudo cost effective. It allows you to do things in a very real and immersive way. And video games, even without the virtual reality headset, allows you to kind of set aside the scary real world for a minute and kind of get into some things that are important to you, and then yet be able to be brought back to the real world and the struggles in a way that's just, you know, so much more sensory based than a lot of the more traditional approaches that we've used in the past.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's definitely the wow factor and the, hey, now I'm listening to you because you're offering to let me play with something I've wanted to play with or know already that I enjoy. Is that it? Are there any other types of things that games do that other toys or games don't?
Well, you know, kind of what I've mentioned before is I think the kids invest more affect and emotion into the video games than they would to a lot of other games, so that in terms of looking at their frustration tolerance, looking at how they decision make, it's not that you can't do them using the other traditional ways. It's just, you know, it's an enjoyable way where you can pop in a disc and be able to kind of assess all of that at one time and work with them on like all those issues kind of at one time. in a way that other games just don't see, you know, more traditional board games, card games, etc., just don't seem to allow for.
You know, another aspect of that, Jamie, would be it's not unusual for parents to present with concerns regarding their child's academic performance, for example. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, when we start talking about it and trying to figure out what's interfering or what's getting in the way, the kids are spending too much time on electronics. It's not board games. But I'll guarantee you that if they were spending, if the what was interfering was TV watching, then we'd address that. If it was reading books too often, we'd address that. Mm-hmm. It's quite common, at least on our practice, that a lot of families are learning and struggling to help their kids balance leisure time with getting homework done, for example. You know, you just kind of meet families where they are. I think you said it earlier, electronic gaming technology has saturated our lives. It's everywhere, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know that so much that there's something superior to the technology. I mean, in a general sense, everybody seems to like it, but it's just there. You might as well meet it and use it and adapt it to the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I think that also kind of brings up a point that, you know, because we do a lot of video game playing with our clients, you know, a lot of times the parents' initial assumption is that we think video games are just phenomenal and the kid should be playing 24 hours a day, which is the last thing they want. And oftentimes what we're doing is also working with the family to set appropriate guidelines and structure. You know, for instance, maybe 2 hours a day at the most. And on the weekends, if you want to go past the 2 hour mark, go outside and play for an hour, and you could earn an extra video game hour to help them kind of incorporate getting outside, etc. Or we'll stop the timer on that. We'll stop the clock on there if you're having friends over and playing. So it's increasing that offline as well as in-game socialization to help that transition pattern as well.
Yeah, we did something similar with my kids when they were younger, where we had like a ticket system and they would get 4 tickets a day and they were each good for 15 minutes of screen time, and they could earn extra tickets by like doing chores or doing other things that we wanted to encourage them to do. And it worked out pretty well, except that they hated it. That was sort of the only downside. But yeah.
Right. Well, and on the one hand, of course, you have that behavioral modification approach of using it as a very salient reinforcer. Mm-hmm. But the other part is more using, you know, really is kind of helping them engage how to make video games an appropriate and not overwhelming part of their lives, of having part of the gameplay be to separate away from the video game or to incorporate with in-person play, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier that some of the people that you've encountered that think video games are evil, or you think that they sort of self-select out of your pool of potential clients because they think gaming is bad, or they have some sort of view about that. So along those lines, like, what are the biggest misunderstandings or unwarranted assumptions about video games and mental health that you've run across and that you wish you could change?
They're pointing at me for this one. I think it's because of my JD. the whole debate on violence and aggression. I mean, that's one big area. You've done some podcasts on that as well.
Right.
I mean, from a common sense perspective, it makes me uncomfortable when I have a family bring in a 7-year-old and he's playing GTA or Call of Duty at home. Mm-hmm. I accept there's research that I don't think that doesn't convince me either way or the other that video games or violent media of any kind, whether it's movies or TV shows, create or contribute to violence. But from a common sense standpoint, as a parent, really, I mean, how it just doesn't make common sense to have, you know, a certain immaturity of kids playing some of those video games. We make a point of talking with parents that when your child reaches the age where you think it's appropriate for them to play violent video games, and not violent in the sense of Smash Brothers or that kind of thing.
Or cartoon violence.
Or cartoon violence. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the legitimate, you know, it's pretty intense.
Some guns and blood.
The new Doom, where your melee is ripping off an arm and clubbing them over the head with it. You know, that's a little much for a young kid, I think.
At the same time, that's a lot of fun.
It is fun.
For me.
Look, I've been playing Doom since it was a PC game.
Right.
The early versions. But the other part of that is a lot of times parents, you know, are trying to make their kids happy and find reinforcers and all that. And that plus social and peer pressure, they'll go out and get the game that the kid wants. And one of the things I encourage them to do is, you don't have to necessarily play the game with the child at home, but make sure you watch what they're playing, you know, because a lot of times it's like, oh, GTA 5. Yeah, I hear everybody's playing it. So yeah, I got it. And it's like, well, have you watched him play? No. Well, go watch him play and come back and give me your impression next week.
Right.
And then you get a very different, a very different reaction. You know, if you're getting ready to buy a game for your child that you've heard a lot about but don't know anything about, I mean, the wonders of YouTube. Go online and watch somebody's gameplay of it to get an idea of what is that game like. And if it's not a problem for you, you know, a game like Halo, for instance, maybe not a problem. You know, you're fine with that, or even Call of Duty. And if you're okay with that, then that's fine. But, you know, we want to make sure that parents are making the choices that they're comfortable making based on having the information.
You know, a subset of that is I encourage parents to also, when your kid starts playing online games and they're using headsets and such,
yeah,
monitor what kind of conversations go on online and make sure that your child's at a maturity level where they're prepared to deal with that as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure I am at a maturity level for that, but yeah.
You know, I mean, so one aspect, one common, I mean, that's a legitimate area in my mind that there are some valid points, especially if you're raising children. But I think it's often used politically in a way that I don't really care for. The second big one is the obsessive play. I loved your, again, I wish I'd wrote down who it was that you did on a podcast talking about addiction versus obsessive play, but they hit it right on the head, you know.
I think that was probably near y'all. I think we talked about that one and habit-forming games. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic. Jamie, I can't tell you how fun it's been as psychologists have been using games for, 15, 20 years to come across the work that you're doing and the speakers that you put on your podcasts. And it's fun picking up your book. It's now a staple on my shelf. It's neat having someone bring together all these different aspects and angles. As a clinician, it's been neat listening to that.
We don't have the time to go out and research and do experimental designs on all this stuff. So the fact that you've culminated not only the ideas, but also some of the experts that are doing that is
I don't do it either. I just talk to the people who have. So, yeah, but that's nice to hear.
So the addiction / obsessive play angle, that's a common misperception. And that's a concerning one. I mean, that comes in a lot where for whatever reason, the family dynamics have set up where kids are playing too much. It's interfering with social. It's interfering with relationships. It's interfering with school performance. That's a tough one. Now,
I know that like psychologists and therapists, when they use the word addiction in this context, they mean something very specific, right? Like, it's different than we may use it in everyday language to talk about something that we're just really interested in or choosing to spend time with. But addiction in this context means something different, right?
When a family comes in using that word, I say that's not appropriate. And now I use the line that I heard on your podcast that, are you going to die if you don't get to play your video game? are you going to suffer? You know,
physical withdrawal.
Yeah, you know, the shakes.
No, yeah. Right. But the obsessive play, helping, you know, I in a way, it's helping learn other coping tools. I'd rather have a kid come in who's coping with things by playing video games too much than cutting themselves or turning to alcohol and drugs. Mm. I mean, there's you know, a lot of other coping tools that are certainly more destructive and dangerous than, you know, obsessively playing a video game.
True.
I think the third area I'd say, you know, one of the biggest misunderstandings we come across after those two negative ones, the third one is kind of a fun one to explain is, hey, there's a lot of positive benefits from gaming. There are pro-social, there are cognitive abilities, there are visual spatial skills. It's neat seeing just more and more research starting to develop and being published about, hey, there are good things about playing video games.
Yeah. That's a lot of that is emerging. And I think a lot of it is, it's easy to get caught up in the marketing, you know, like brain training games and that sort of stuff. And there's a lot of debate recently about how effective those are. But I don't think, like you said, I don't think you can escape the idea that, like, hey, these things help you develop social skills. They help you develop coping. They help you deal with failure and learning how to fail and figure out what you're doing wrong and learn.
Right.
Okay. Well, anything else you want to talk about that you've done there? Any other huge like success stories that you think illustrate well what you've done and what other people in doing similar work have done?
We don't get much communication with other professionals. One point. It's neat getting feedback from agencies or schools that did continue some of the programs that we put in there using group play and that they're still going on like 10 years later. I mean, that's validating. It's neat that we seem to have no end of undergraduate and graduate students coming to us asking to do internships. We've had mental health professionals fly in and come see our groups and work with us in a group. And we probably get a call every 2-3 months from somebody somewhere around the country saying, hey, we saw your website, we saw the article. Any more ideas on we're thinking about using video games, you know, in the practice?
Mm-hmm.
I like Brian said, it's tough keeping up with what's going on outside our bubble when I'm typically in here at 9 a.m. and I'm going till 9 p.m. And when school starts, I'm in here on Saturdays and Sundays as well, trying to keep up with the demand of families looking for help.
Yeah, I think one other thing I kind of wanted to say fairly specifically, and this was also something that Dr. Coward had made a reference to, which I was really excited about, because it's really been kind of a core concept on some of the on the way we do video game work, and that is the off-the-shelf approach. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of research that's been done for using video games in therapy that are based on what people refer to as quote unquote serious games, games designed from the ground up to address anxiety mm-hmm. or post-traumatic stress or medical in terms of how to fight off all the mean little cancer monsters, et cetera, et cetera. And I think those are really nice and there's been a certain amount of effectiveness of it, but you know, especially in the realm that we're working, keeping up with technology, keeping up with kids' interests. You know, you spend a lot of money and time and energy creating a video game from the ground up that is almost outdated as soon as it comes out. I mean, look at the commercial field. I mean, look at, you know, how many Call of Duty versions are there out there? You know, the sports games, you know, have to come up with one every year to update the players. You know, to come up with a serious game that is both useful for more than a year and a half is really challenging. So that's one of the reasons why we found just what is out there. And, you know, we just upgrade, you know, instead of having to spend, you know, thousands of dollars to create a game each year, you know, we go out and spend $20 to $60 to get, you know, the newest game of this or that.
Well, I know that we've been talking for about an hour now. I don't want to keep you all day, but to kind of start wrapping things up, what have you guys been playing outside of, you know, working with your clients? Like, what are you into these days?
We'll let Mrs. Messer go first, and she's the least gamer of us all.
My,
what have you been playing with?
Yeah, my husband and my kids got me into Pokemon Go.
Okay.
She's been going walking with me.
I've been going walking.
That's great. I went for some really long walks with my daughter when we were into it. She's still into it, but I burned out on it just because I didn't think.
Yeah,
there was...
I agree. But what a neat father-daughter activity, Jay.
Yeah, right.
I know. Or mother-son
yeah. or whatever. Yeah. Just that's.
Yeah, it's awesome.
What have you been playing, Brian?
Well, lately I've been getting into the PlayStation VR, but you know, I kind of also wanted to say my three probably all-time favorite games. One goes all the way back to Wolfenstein 3D for the PC.
Going way.
One
back.
Is Portal 2, and I hope they'll come out with a Portal 3 someday. And then
Mass Effect.
Mass Effect was a great game for me because it was kind of the first real RPG with a lot of decision-making that affected outcome. Because although I haven't found a way to incorporate it with therapy yet, I love the idea of being able to use video games to that kind of long-term cause and effect of your choices.
Yeah, what would you say your favorite three games are? What was you said the other night?
Heroes.
Oh, Pac-Man. She said this came up with Pac-Man when I told her about that in the arcade. That's how far back that goes. Playing in the arcade. Pokemon Go is what I played recently. I enjoyed the Pokemon Go as a nice break. I've always been a RuneScaper, 11 years now. Minecraft is probably my second game, and I keep Minecraft going in part because every kid who comes in who's in either elementary or middle school, the first thing when they come in for their first day, I meet with the parents first to find out attitudes towards video games. You know, if the family's negative attitudes for it, then that I know I'm probably not going to use games. Even when the kid comes in for the first time, if I'm able to engage that kid right off the bat about, you know, what their problems are and how to fix them, I won't necessarily go to gaming. But most of the time, the kid will come in, I'll do the intake, and about halfway through I'll say, oh, by the way, I've got to give you homework. And I'll get the typical, shoulders slumped and, oh, really, they'll look at their parent like, look, you're bringing me here and I'm having homework. And then I'll turn on the Xbox One and pull up the Minecraft world that for almost 4 or 5 years now, hundreds and hundreds of kids have all built something in this world. So it's become pretty large with a incredibly diverse collection of ideas that kids have come up to build, from art to buildings to just everything. And so I'll turn to the kid, all right, your homework assignment is think of what you'll add to this Minecraft map. And then I'll spend 5 or 10 minutes letting them fly around just this huge map of looking at different things people have put together. So cool. I've Minecraft is kind of I enjoy doing the Minecraft and kind of messing around with that and getting that ready for the kids. And then the whole Pokemon series. I can't wait for Sun and Moon to come out.
Yeah, you know what I mean? You and
so
my
we
daughter.
Already have our reservations.
We already have our copy reserved.
Very cool. That's my daughter is looking forward to that one as too. She's hugely into it and will regale me with stats and types and what evolves into what and so forth. And that was all. I was too old by the time that Pokemon hit the States and became as popular as it did. So I missed that phenomenon. I threatened to start telling her about Dungeons and Dragons, like loot tables and like monster stats, which was what I was into.
No, that's our Thursday nights.
That's what we do on Thursday night. That's right.
So very cool. So if somebody wanted to find out more about what you guys do, or potentially somebody in the Buffalo area or any other area you serve might think that they can make use of your services, where would they go on the internet to find out more about you and the work that you do?
www.electronicgamingtherapy.com. Yeah, that'll steer them this way.
Very cool. This has been really interesting, and I'm glad that you guys are out there doing this work and leveraging games to do it. I think sometimes we need all the help that we can get, both as a profession and just sort of gamers. And it sounds like you're pairing that with a real love for the hobby and an understanding of it as well, which is great. So keep up the good work.
You too, Jamie. I'll say it again. We really, it's been a pleasant surprise coming across the stuff that you're doing.
Great. That's always nice to hear. I appreciate it. Hey, you did it. You made it to the end of another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming along. I hope you enjoyed it. I thought it was a really interesting discussion. If you have any stories or comments that you'd like to share, you can go to psychologyofgames.com and pretty easily find the blog entry that goes with this episode of the podcast, and you can let me know about it there, or you can find out how to follow me on social media, contact me through email, do any of that other sort of fun stuff. And you can also find out how to support the Psychology of Games website on Patreon, patreon.com/POG for Psychology of Games. Thanks for listening again, and I will see you next episode.